We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night. Ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end...
What will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Sarah Stoudy was in the hospital, and it was a very confusing time for her. She's only 24, and all of the doctors are scrambling around her. They're running tests, they're panicked, they say her condition is not good. It's critical, to be frank, because Sarah Stoudy's organs, at only 24 years old, are failing. But let me explain why this is so weird. She had started getting sick a few days prior to this, and her mom and her sister, Diane and Rachel, they didn't really think much of it. This was probably the worst illness that Sarah had ever felt. She couldn't really even get out of bed. And finally, after a couple days, her mom, Diane, and her sister, Rachel, are like, fine, okay, yeah, we'll take you. They didn't seem too concerned about her condition. And Sarah trusted her sister. And Sarah trusted her mother. So, if Sarah's sister and Sarah's mother say that nothing's wrong, then maybe nothing's wrong. Maybe it's just all in her head. When Sarah gets to the hospital, the doctors and nurses are scrambling. They're concerned. They tell her that her organs are failing. I can only imagine how disorienting this must be. Your mother and sister say everything is fine, and the doctors are the only ones that are concerned about you. Not to mention, only a few months prior to this, her father and her brother also passed away. But no one ever seems concerned about the Stoudy family until it's too late. Welcome back to Sinister, a show on Mondays where we focus primarily on female killers. If that is something up your alley, then I'll see ya next Monday and every Monday after that. If you're new and you're listening on audio or on YouTube, remember you can listen to all of the past episodes of Sinister. The show has just started. You're not too far behind. You still have time to catch up. Mark Stoudy was born in 1951 in Missouri. And one thing that everyone knew about Mark was that he loved music. He loved it. I mean, he was the type of person that was very, like, nice, kind, considerate, and very, very outgoing. Mark was the type of person that would come up, talk to you about something, and then just be on his merry way and maybe talk to you the next couple of days like he knew you. He was very outgoing, very, very nice, very sociable. But despite everybody's experience with how outspoken and kind and fun he was, they knew, first of all, that Mark loved music. That was the most important thing. That is how they would describe him best. Years later, he even went on to meet his wife, Diane Stoudy, at a bluegrass concert. He was a big blues fan, and one thing that I love about this personally is that if you're gonna listen to blues or you're gonna sing the blues, usually you have some kind of sadness that you can kind of connect to, and you're letting it out with music. People that are a fan of blues music, which, by the way, I know is different than bluegrass, but we'll get to why I say he's so into blues later. People that are into it, they get it. Sometimes they kind of have this hole in their heart that they just let out through music. And in those moments, it feels like you're fulfilled. He was a guy that liked those gritty, kind of sad, dark parts of music, but then also he loved rock music, he loved bluegrass, he loved having a good time. When he met Diane at the Bluegrass Music Festival, I can only imagine how good of a headspace he's in. Like, you know, you guys know when you go to a festival and all of your favorite bands are playing, you're there with friends, you've dedicated the whole day to this, the world is your oyster, you do whatever you want. That might be how Mark was feeling that day when he meets Diane. She's sweet. She's adorable. She's also a musician. She had played the piano since she was 3 years old. Her mom taught her. She's here to see some of the bands that he likes. And on top of that, they went to the same college. It was St. John's College. Diane was actually studying to be a nurse. While they're dating, Diane ends up getting pregnant, and they decide not only do they want to keep the child, they're also going to get married. Oh, and they are both going to continue their education. I think that this is just kind of an ideal scenario in the 80s. You know, your kids go off, they meet somebody, they have a baby, but they decide to get married after that, and then they're going to finish school. Like, this is great. This is great. And that's exactly what they did. They got married in late December, and then just a couple months later, in July, they had their first child, Sean Stoudy. The relationship is just like any other relationship in the United States at the time, you know? They had Sean, and then they had Sarah, then they had Rachel, then they had Brianna. Brianna actually came about 10 years after the other kids, but they had a nice, happy family. By 2012, Mark and Diane had essentially done their job as parents because, you know, they raised their kids. But all of the kids were still living at home. Sean was 26 years old. He was on the autism spectrum, but he had a lot of interests, wanted to get out and see the world, and he was trying, you know? He loved architecture. He was really into Sweden. Like, he really, really wanted to visit Sweden. He was into mechanics. He loved comic books. They said that you could give Sean a comic book and he'd be like, okay. And he would just hang out there for like an hour or two and just do his thing. Sarah had a degree in French. She spoke French and really wanted to get out to Paris, go see the world. And so did Rachel. She wanted to go to Tokyo. So the kids had dreams, but they didn't really go out and pursue them or seek them. One reason that I think this could be, this is just my general inference, is Diane and Mark didn't really model kind of a go-getter career attitude for the kids. You know, Mark kind of just picked up odd jobs over the years, while Diane was the breadwinner of the house, essentially. But really, she just played piano at a local church. About 15 years prior to 2012, she worked in a hospital. And ironically, she was working at St. John's right after she graduated college. And I guess she just decided she didn't like it. And she went into being an organist at her local church. Between Diane just being very content with her job and just kind of like not pursuing more with her nursing career, and Mark just trying to pick up odd jobs to make some money in between, I feel like the kids didn't have a really great model of parents that were up and at them and going out after their careers and getting out and seeing the world. They didn't know how to even get started with it, even though they really wanted it. Another thing that was a little depressing about the Stoudy home was it was in complete disarray. When you look at the crime scene photos of the Stoudy house, you will see things just kind of strewn about. I mean, this wasn't like straight hoarder style where there's piles and piles of clothes everywhere and food and bags and things just piled all the way up to the walls. But it definitely wasn't tidy. It was beyond untidy. It was almost as though nothing in the house had a home. Things were all over the place and nobody cared. It's just how the home was. And they accepted it. Probably because the children didn't really know how. And, you know, for Diane, this just like wasn't a priority. This is really important to me because a lot of times when children grow up in really, really messy and disorganized homes, it can often happen because a parent doesn't know how to clean, or maybe they're really depressed and they don't have help. But then this chaos and this disorganization becomes very, very normalized for kids. If kids have never known a clean and organized home, this affects them greatly because they'll probably either grow up to be on one side of the extreme, either constantly cleaning, feeling like they can only have control of their environment and feel safe if everything is perfectly in order, or they might grow up to be somebody that embraces the chaos, never having a home for any of their objects, everything strewn about, and believing that that's what they deserve, that they deserve to live in chaos, they deserve to live in filth. So having a disorganized home affects people in a lot of different ways. And there were three different children in that house that lived there for over 20 years. Another thing about the Stoudy home was it was only 900 square feet with six people living in it. Not only was the house a mess a lot of the time and nobody cared, but there was no privacy. Now, I'm not sure how many bedrooms were in the Stoudy house, but with that size, we could probably assume that it was a 2, maybe 3 bedroom house. If you were one of the 6 people living there and you were lucky enough to get one of those rooms to yourself for even a few minutes and to be able to shut the door and just exist in your own private space, you would still hear every single thing going on in the house on the other side of the door. These children and these parents had no privacy. Their lives seemed to all be woven together with a thread of confusion and maybe a little depression. But the Stoudy kids had dreams of getting out and seeing the world. Well, by 2012, something kind of good was happening. Something pretty sick, if I'm being honest. Mark Stoudy had joined a band. And it was called Messing with Destiny. I love this. I love it so much. I love that it's blues. I love that Mark was the lead singer and he's singing his heart out, playing guitar, sometimes playing the harmonica, and the name, Messing with Destiny, it's sick. I need so badly for you to imagine for a moment that you're an older guy, you've lived in Springfield, Missouri for most of your life, all of your life, really. You raise your kids, you get married, you know, you do all the big, heavy life stuff, but you've always, always loved music and wanted to be in a band. And one day, when you're 60 years old, your friends say, Mark, let's get out there and let's start a band. I wouldn't be surprised if anyone had asked him this, you know, decades ago, but he's probably like, oh, I got the kids. Or, oh, my wife wants me to work. Like, I need to do this. Like, da 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 da. Well, look, the kids were in their 20s. Mark was 60. He had nothing to lose. He said, yes, boys, let's go. He started playing in Messing with Destiny, and look, it wasn't a super, super famous band or anything. They might have been paid like $100 or $200 a night, and then all the guys in the band would have to split that up, you know? But it's the principle. Getting paid to do what you love, no matter what the dollar amount is truly such a blessing, and it's just a great feeling. Can you imagine after these nights where they play the shows, like, you know, you and your boys going out playing these venues in Springfield that you've been attending for years and years and years, you do your own show with your friends, and then afterwards it's like, all right guys, let's use the $100, grab a pizza and a couple of beer. Oh my god, like, Mark was living his dream. But also, his band was definitely a way for him to express himself, because I was diving into this a little bit and I wanted to hear his music. You know, he was the front man of the band. He was a songwriter and the main singer. One of their more popular songs that you can still find online is one that's called Female Judas. You're just a female Judas. You wanna see me? If you're not familiar with the Bible or Christianity, Judas Iscariot was the primary person that betrayed Jesus. So to write a song called Female Judas must be about a woman that you feel is betraying you. And that's exactly what Mark depicts in the song. Well, you took everything from me, baby. You even took away. In fact, I would say it's quite dark. And look, I'm gonna tell you right now, Mark is singing on the track with some soul. He means it. But of course, the question is, who is the female Judas? Well, he's a songwriter, so that's not gonna come out bluntly. But if you keep listening, the lyrics get even darker. Well, you can go out to hang yourself, a woman. I'll supply. Now, this is a song, and a lot of times in songwriting, people use metaphors or say things that we don't necessarily need to take verbatim, but I think that line is so heavy that it's safe to say that Mark really does not trust this female Judas. Now, Messing with Destiny didn't have any major commercial success. There was a point in time where they were actually supposed to do a really big show, and I think it was the highest they'd been paid for a show, and they were playing alongside an Aretha Franklin cover band. But for them, you guys gotta remember, they had been playing these venues for years, they had known each other for a while, and like, God, how fun. How fun to be living out your dream finally after like all the work in life is done, you know? Now, on April 6th, 2012, Messing with Destiny had a really big recording session coming up.
We took it all. We brought them to our land. An endless night, ember hot and icy cold. The rage of the earth. We made this curse. Carved it in the blood on our backs. We did not see. We could not, but she did. And in the end,
what will I become?
Senua Saga. Hellblade 2.
Play it now with Game Pass.
Prior to that, though, just a few days earlier, Mark Stoudy's son, Sean Stoudy, would start to make some very strange Facebook posts. They didn't get a lot of traction at the time, but now they are an insane piece of the puzzle to everything that's going on. On April 1st, 2012, Sean Stoudy posted, "My father is suffering from an incurable mental illness and is likely to die." The posts progressed. The next day, Sean wrote, "My father is slowly starting to have problems with driving and accomplishing anything. When he drove a car, the car swerved a bit. I had to help him keep the car direction straight and properly turn." A few days later, Sean posted, "My father is so insane that I don't want to be friends with him anymore." On April 6th, Sean also posted, "I need a better life." Now, the day that Sean posted that was the same day that Mark Stoudy was supposed to show up to the recording studio to play with Messing with Destiny. When he arrived, his bandmates noticed that he was kind of confused, very disoriented. One of his bandmates, Robert, actually said that his skin was yellow. And they had just seen Mark, like, you know, the week prior to this, and he seemed fine. But now he's slurring. He is very just out of it. They're surprised he even got there. And he can't perform. So they say, "Mark, go get on out of here. Go home, rest up, and get better." So he does. He goes home. In fact, the very next day, April 7th, was his birthday. He had turned 61 years old. On this day, Sean posted, "My father is slowly getting sicker. His voice is slurred. His walking is wobbly." Mark had a weird mix of flu-like symptoms, but also these very serious neurological issues that have been popping up for a few days, and the yellow skin, jaundice. It was a pretty confusing situation, and I think most people would be very alarmed. However, Diane was not alarmed. Diane had two things in her pocket. One, God, pray away, whatever. She's praying, we're praying, we're praying. You guys know how I feel about that. And two, she was a nurse. She said, "Mark, you're fine. Nothing's wrong. I'm going to church." And she did. Easter Sunday, April 8th, 2012, Diane went to church. After she left church, she came home. She said Mark was still sleeping, and this did not alarm her. But Mark was not sleeping. He was dead. And on April 9th, Sean Stoudy posted, "My father died. He lived a full life. The cause of his death is a stroke. His funeral is this week. His belongings now belong to my sisters." Now this is really what blows my mind. Mark was only 61 years old. The man was in pretty decent health because he was getting up there and singing on a stage with his band, right? For some reason, the coroner looks at this and says, "Oh, yeah, I think this is natural causes. I think, oh, maybe it's a stroke, maybe it's a something." There was no full examination done. The one thing they did note was that Mark had a ring of blood around his mouth, which I feel, listen, guys, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a nurse, but I feel like you guys that are doctors, nurses, like any medical thing, that ring of blood around the mouth has to be telling something. It has to be telling something. I don't know. You tell me. But I'm losing my mind over it because they cremated Mark's body, didn't do a full medical examination, and then went on their way to have a service. Oh, and then, get this, Diane had the audacity to post this. Sorry, you guys can tell I'm feeling a type of way about this. Diane posted, "For all my friends on Facebook, this past Sunday evening, Mark, my husband of 27 years, reached his eternal home." And then she posted a quote from John, a book in the Bible. "Let not your hearts be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you myself, that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way to where I am going." I don't know why she posted this. To me, it gives off the vibe of her trying to say, like, hey, this was Jesus's decision to take my husband, and I accept Jesus's decision. I personally do not F with this, because even if I was, like, still a hardcore Christian, if I'm worshiping Jesus and you take my husband abruptly at 60 years old, I thought we made it out the woods. I thought we did this shit, bro. I thought we made it through, like, all the really tough years. Now we're 60. We're supposed to push on to 80 and be together forever. Jesus, you ain't going to take my husband, and I'm just going to accept it and say, oh, this is what Jesus wanted. So just in my opinion, like, this is really weird behavior from Diane. And, like, obviously, yo, also, I'm just on one right now. I don't know what type of true crime podcast you guys normally listen to, but I just want you to know, here, I'm invested and it comes through. I cannot turn it off. I really tried in the beginning of the podcast. I really tried. I was like, this, and, like, I have all the research. I'm telling you the story. But, like, listen, bro, I'm still invested. I'm mad. I'm super mad. Fuck this status. Anyways, all of this happens very quickly on the weekend of Mark's birthday. And on Friday, April 20th, 2012, they hold the memorial service at the church. I need a hero in this story so bad. I really do. I haven't even gotten to, like, the crazy stuff yet. And, like, I need a hero. Remember I told you guys that Diane was a organist at the church for, actually, it was over 30 years. She'd been there for a long time, but she was working it full time for, like, the last 15 years. Well, she's somebody that's always at the church and somebody that is important at the church. So, of course, day in and day out, the pastor, his name was Jeff Sippy, he is used to seeing Diane a lot. He officiated the service and he felt really bad for Diane. He did, but he also kind of was looking at her. The remaining members of Messing with Destiny performed a tribute at his funeral. I don't know why. I'm really tied to the band. I'm tied to the fact that he did that. I'm really glad that he got to live his dream for a while. And there's actually a special on 2020, if you guys are curious about more details of this case, where they actually interview Robert Mancuso, who is one of the band members. And the way he talks about their time in Messing with Destiny, the way that he talks about Mark is just so sweet. It makes me angry with how everything played out. So he was cremated after the service and his ashes were quickly scattered in the lake. If you're somebody that watches a lot of true crime, you might agree with me on these points. There's a couple things that I noticed that happen over and over and over and over in cases. One of which is, in the interrogation, 9 times out of 10, somehow the killer will throw the victim under the bus. As we cover lots of different cases on Sinister, I will try to point out to you when this happens. Another thing that happens quite often in true crime cases is that when somebody doesn't want a body to be tested, they will try to get rid of the body as quickly as possible. Once he was cremated, Diane received a payout from Mark's life insurance of $20,000. The memorial service happened in late April and the insurance payout came shortly after. Diane decided to buy a new house. This time, this one was about 1,300 square feet and it had 3 bedrooms and 2 full bathrooms. It was also in a nicer part of town. According to one of the deeds, Diane borrowed about $72,000 for this home and it had a value of $79,000 at the time. This means that she put down about $6,000 or $7,000 was able to hold on to the rest and also sold her previous home. Diane had a little bit of cash at this point. But before she sold her home, tragedy struck the Stoudy family again. Diane called 911 and the police littered the street. When people in the neighborhood saw that police were at the home and the ambulances, everyone started saying, "What happened? What happened?" They were new to this neighborhood. People didn't know them very well. And when they spoke to the family, the Stoudies just said, and this is crazy to me, the Stoudies said there had been a death. They didn't say who. They didn't express any shock, grief, surprise, anything. They just said that there had been a death. Their oldest brother, Sean, 26 years old, was found dead in their home, and their response is, "There's been a death." I really try my best not to judge people's reactions when somebody close to them is murdered or passes away, because everybody responds differently. But I find not acknowledging your brother's existence, not showing any surprise or sadness, and almost wanting to sweep it under the rug, very strange. Very, very, very strange. When the police spoke to Diane, she told them that Sean had been experiencing flu-like symptoms for over 3 weeks. She didn't take him to the hospital because he was staying hydrated. Never mind that her husband had abruptly died months prior to this, also from flu-like symptoms. She just said, "Oh, he's drinking water. It should be fine." And there was one other small detail. And once again, I call on my doctors and my nurses because I don't know, but very red flaggy to me, Sean also had this ring of blood around his mouth. But his death, according to the coroner, was caused by, quote, prior medical issues. Sean, after his passing, didn't get an obituary. He didn't get a ceremony. He got nothing except having his body sent to be cremated as quickly as possible. Now, if you guys remember, I told you earlier that Sean had a form of autism. His mom immediately said, "Oh, well, he has autism and he has a lot of seizures. So it was probably something with that." And they just wrote it down and went on. I can't. On Tuesday, September 4th, Diane takes to Facebook again, this time saying, "To my Facebook friends and family, it's been hard for me to come up with the right words, but here goes. On Sunday, my oldest child, Sean, died. Although he had been sick lately, we thought he was getting better. Thank you to those who have called or messaged me. Please continue to pray for us during this time." Unreal. Bro, Oh, I wish so badly, so desperately that I would stop giving my angry commentary within this podcast. I can't help it. I know, bro. I know. People on Facebook were looking at this like, what the fuck? The minute that she said, "Although he had been sick lately, we thought he was getting better," I thought that there would be more to talk about her son, his life, her feelings, what happened, anything. Nope, she just immediately moved to pray for us. It drives me nuts. Like, there's no way that people on Facebook didn't look at this and raise an eyebrow and be like, "God, this is like kind of weird, no?" But everyone has to stay cordial face to face, right? So people start saying, "Oh my God, this is so awful for Diane. It must be really hard to lose your husband and your son in such a short year." Of course, everyone's going to be cordial because they don't know a lot of these little details that I'm telling you right now. They don't know about the ring of blood around the mouth. They don't know about, you know, the flu-like symptoms for a few weeks. They just heard, "Oh, they were sick." So a lot of people are not going to question a woman that just lost her husband and her son. But there was one person that knew Diane pretty well and thought her reaction was a little strange. And that person was Jeff Sippy, the pastor. After Sean passed away, Rachel Stoudy moved into his room. It was a 3-bedroom home, so maybe the girls were sharing a room prior to this, and this was gonna be her finally getting her own room. But later on, Rachel said that she hated being in that room. It had bad feelings, it had bad energy in there, and she had a lot of nightmares. She said she didn't like it. And, you know, later on in the police interrogation, she says it just like that. It's so strange. It's not an energy of my brother died slowly in this room. I can feel that energy. It's making me upset. She spoke of it as though it was gross being in there and she didn't like it. But time goes on and the Stouties try to recover. At this point, it is only 2013. Oh yes, everything I've told you so far happened all in the course of a year. At this point, it is now just Diane Stouty, Sarah Stouty, Rachel Stouty, and Brianna Stouty. But things start to look grim when Sarah is also rushed to the hospital. And now we're back to the beginning of the story that I was telling you earlier. Sean and Mark were having symptoms for weeks prior to their deaths. Painful symptoms, confusing symptoms. And Diane, the nurse and arguably matriarch of the house, told them it was nothing to worry about. Keep drinking water. Did you drink your water today? You're fine. These men felt like they were dying. And now it started happening to Sarah. But her mom made sure that she was staying hydrated and she was okay and everything would be good. And now there's this energy of panic and people wanting to save her and people being concerned for her and people knowing just how serious this is. Sarah is in her 20s, her early 20s, and her organs are failing. My God, why did it take so long for her to get here? This is what everyone's thinking. And I can only imagine how disorienting this must be for her, because the people she trusts, her mother and her sister, oh, everything's fine. Oh, you're fine. And over here, chaos, chaos. Sarah, what do you need? Sarah, we need to get you in for another test. We might have to operate. These tests came back negative. This doesn't make any sense. This is falling. This is falling. At just 24 years old, she was in critical condition. Her kidneys were failing and her brain was failing. The doctors told Diane that it was a slim to none chance that she was gonna make it. Diane doesn't really tell anybody. She's not taken to Facebook yet. She's not talking about it too much, but other people start talking and it gets back to the congregation. And guess who hears about it from the congregation? Jeff Sippy. Now, in most of the stories that talk about this case, they will tell you that an anonymous tipper called. I'ma tell you just straight up, the anonymous tipper was Jeff Sippy. And Jeff said, in all of my years of being a pastor and meeting so many people and touching so many lives and understanding so many families, I've never seen somebody lose their husband, not care, lose their son, not care. And then when their daughter is in the hospital, not only does she not care again, but she's not telling anybody. And Jeff said, that is weird. I gotta ring the alarm on this one. We got a good Christian. We got a good Christian, because y'all know sometimes people be up in the church like, well, that's not my business. Or they just want to watch. They just want to watch the fallout. No. Jeff Sippy said, God is listening and I have a duty. I have a responsibility to let the police know that something weird is going on and they need to look into Diane Stouty, because I have never seen this before. In the call, the tipster noted Diane's lack of emotion after Mark died. He thought that Diane's reaction was very odd. He also told the police that he and Mark were close and they would go out for coffee once a month. They would catch up on a regular basis. They knew each other super well. And he could not think of a single thing that would cause Mark to just die. It didn't make any sense. And then coupled with Diane's reaction, Jeff was like, this just doesn't sit right with me. And then he also said, after Sean died, a young man, there was a complete lack of emotion from Diane, even less emotion. And that's when he was like, something doesn't smell right. Now, after the tip came in, a detective named Neil McCamus, he started looking at the cases. He was trying to look at the similarities between Mark's death and Sean's death. He's noticing these similarities. The detective decided to actually go up to the hospital. Immediately when he gets there, the nurse is like, bro, something kind of weird is going on because her daughter is dying. I have seen families when somebody is in critical condition like this, and Diane is over here cracking jokes, joking about her daughter's condition, talking about taking this vacation in Florida. So the detective goes and speaks with another doctor, and the doctor says, "We performed so many tests. Nothing is coming up positive. Nothing is telling us what happened. We think this might be a poisoning case." And the detective is like, they're locked in. They're locked in. And obviously, who are we going to talk to? Diane Stoudy. The investigation begins and all eyes are on Diane. Rightfully so. They start to question friends, family, anyone that was involved. Rob, one of the bandmates in Messing with Destiny, he said that after Mark died, Diane's demeanor was as though she was hosting a party. He said there was no grief. There was no sadness. All the members of the band were a lot more upset and dismayed than she was. He described it as Diane celebrating in everyone's face. And then later, they spoke with other family members that said when Sean Stoudy died, they never heard about it. They didn't hear about it from Diane. Nobody called them. They didn't know for the longest time until they heard from other friends and family members in the neighborhood. Now, like I said, there was no obituary, there was no ceremony, no nothing. And I'm not sure if Diane either didn't want to spend the money on the obituary and the ceremony or the writer or anything, or if she was trying to keep his death under wraps and not make it a big situation, or maybe a little bit of both. Remember I said earlier that Diane was making Facebook posts about the situations and they just kind of read as odd? Well, her daughter Rachel also made a post, but I thought this one was very, very strange. Before I tell you what this one said, one thing to note about Rachel Stoudy and her mom, Diane Stoudy, was they were best friends. They were best friends. And it was very evident through their Facebook posts, because when they were posting about things not related to death, they would respond back and forth to each other. Like, Rachel was her mom's best friend. And I think that Rachel enjoyed being the favorite child, because a lot of times, if there's sibling rivalry or multiple kids in the family, feeling like you're the favorite child can make you feel safe. Now, a month after Sean Stoudy died, Rachel posted on Facebook and said, "Don't think I've seen mom this chilled out for a long time." I think that Facebook status was for mom. It wasn't for anybody else on Facebook. It read really weird to most people. But I think to Rachel, she was signaling to her mom, like, "Wow, you're so relaxed now. I support you. I'm on your team. I'm your teammate." Finally, after the tipster, investigators are all over this, and they finally bring Diane Stoudy in for questioning on June 20th in 2013. Now, Sarah is still in the hospital at this point, and when they start to question her about it, one of the first things, I'm literally in disbelief. One of the first things that she said about her daughter, Sarah, who was in the hospital suffering from organ failure, was she said that Sarah was difficult and it was hard to get her to the hospital. She said it wasn't her fault that there was such a delay bringing her daughter in. She said it was because Sarah was difficult. The killer will almost always throw the victim under the bus. She told the officer, "I didn't hurt my kids, if that's what you're insinuating I did. I didn't do that. I would never hurt my kids." And when asked about Mark, she said, "When Mark died, it was actually a relief. I just don't tell people that." The investigators didn't press her too hard, but Diane started kind of throwing things out about wanting an attorney. So the detectives kind of switch into a good cop, bad cop situation. If you haven't seen a lot of interrogations before, one thing that they might do is give people an out, butter them up and say, like, "Well, did something happen? Was he doing something? Was he doing something that made you want to protect the kids?" They'll try to feed the suspect something that makes them think that they're going to be on their side, that they can get out of this. And so they don't want her to ask for an attorney. So they kind of start to shift this a little bit. And she takes the bait. She straight up tells them in a very monotone voice that she'd been putting antifreeze in Mark's Gatorade for weeks before he died. The investigators don't act too shocked. They want to keep everything calm, kind of mellow. She's already talking. This is a huge admission. And they want her to keep going. And they say, why? What happened? And she said, oh, I was sick of him. I hated his guts at this point. You know, he would throw things at me. And this is a shocking, shocking admission. But the investigators, they need to stay calm. And they were like, well, what was going on with Sean? And she said, he was annoying. That's what she said. He was irritating and he didn't do chores. I am not kidding. That is why Diane Stoudy said that she poisoned her 26-year-old son. She admitted that she had been putting antifreeze in Sean's Coca-Cola, and she had also begun to do it with Sarah. Now, this was all in 2013, but something crazy happened just the year prior. The primary thing that kills people in antifreeze is ethylene glycol, and it is a sweet substance. It's very, very sweet, and you can't really taste it if you mix it in with something else that's sweet. Ethylene glycol having an odorless, colorless, and sweet taste to it was a huge problem. Not only because people were poisoning each other with antifreeze, but because it was very common that a large container of antifreeze would be left somewhere, or maybe there was a puddle somewhere, and animals would come up and lick the puddle of this sweet thing, and they would die. Something called the Humane Society Legislative Fund was estimating that up to 10,000 dogs were dying per year as a result of ethylene glycol poisoning. So, with all of this information, in 2012, they banded together and they begged and they pleaded for antifreeze producers to add a bittering agent into the concoction. And they did. It was completely voluntary, but pretty much everyone picked it up, except just a few producers of antifreeze. Diane Stoudy knew that this bittering agent had recently been added into almost all productions of antifreeze, so she went out of her way to go online and look for an old formula of antifreeze. She ordered it, and she put it into their drinks. And just like that, to a lot of people's shock and dismay, she admitted to poisoning her husband of 27 years, Mark Stoudy. She admitted to poisoning her son. She admitted to poisoning her daughter, who was still in the hospital and had very little chance of survival. She claimed in the interview, she said she regretted it. She said that she was stupid. And she said, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have done it. But of course, there's always another storyline here, right? Because 2 days later, on June 22nd, Rachel Stoudy was questioned after they found her journal. An entry in her journal said, "It's sad when I realize how my father will pass on in the next 2 months. Sean, my brother, will move on shortly after. It will be tough getting used to the changes, but everything will work out." It was dated June 13th, 2011, which was nearly a year before Rachel's dad died. There was also a strange note that they found in Rachel's purse, and it was just a little poem or a line, and it said, "Only the quiet ones will be left, my mother, my little sister, and me." When the investigators confronted her about this information, she told them, "Oh no, 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 this was just about a bad dream that I had about my family members dying. I was just writing about my bad dream." But just like her mom, with a little bit of questioning, she cracked. Now, I think that there were a couple of mechanisms at play in this situation, because Rachel Stoudy was aware that her mother was poisoning other members of the family, and to an extent, she aided and abetted. One dynamic that is very possible is something called intimacy bonding over a common enemy. It's when you and another person basically talk a bunch of smack about somebody that you don't like, and then you feel like you and that other person are closer because you have something that you hate together. This happens very, very often when a new girlfriend is talking about her ex, and the new boyfriend hates the ex-boyfriend, and they, you know, chatter about how much they hate this guy, and these two feel like they're getting closer because they hate the same person, but that closeness isn't real. Intimacy bonding over a common enemy is very, very common. You also see it with parents talking about ex-spouses and talking to their children about it. If you had a parent that bonded with you over hating somebody or gossiping, you would know. You would feel it because it feels like the only way that mom will let you in or get close to you is when you're talking smack about somebody else that she hates. That's one dynamic that I can see in this. Another one, do you remember what I mentioned earlier that sometimes being the favorite child means safety? Well, in this case, when mom is a predator, the safety isn't just, I feel safe because I know you love me and I'm the favorite. Now the safety is, you're not going to kill me because I'm the one you're closest to. Rachel knew that her father, who had stayed home to raise her for over 20 years, and her brother that she had shared space with were dying. She knew that their mother was going to kill them. She knew that they were dying when their mother started to poison them, and she did absolutely nothing. So regardless of her wanting mommy's love or wanting to be close or looking for safety, I have very, very, very little pity for Rachel. Another thing is, it seems like it was only a matter of time before Brianna got a little bit older and possibly either started annoying mom and was at risk of being killed, or got old enough to where Rachel felt like she was in competition for mom's love with her. What happens there? I do feel like Rachel was manipulated and followed her mother into the dark in such a way. But also, Rachel is an adult. Rachel watched her family die. Rachel didn't say anything. And Rachel is a piece of shit. When Rachel was asked why they killed or attempted to kill each member of the family, she said that the reason they murdered her dad was because they wanted, quote, a little peace in the home. For Sean, she verbatim said, because he was annoying. And for Sarah, she said it was because Sarah was nosy. Another question the investigators asked was, okay, well, if you were poisoning Mark and Sean over the period of a couple days or weeks, and you let them die in the home, why this time did you choose to take Sarah to the hospital? And Rachel said, I didn't want another one to die in the house because houses are nasty after someone has died in them. But she did actually say that most likely her youngest sister, Brianna, was going to die too. At the time of this interrogation, Brianna was actually now 11 years old. And they asked her, were you going to kill her too? And she said, yeah, sometime after Sarah. I don't believe this. I think that Rachel wanted her mother all to herself. Because those weird Facebook statuses, the weird Facebook statuses just kept coming. And one post, shortly after Mark Stouty's death, Rachel posted, strangers think I'm quiet. My friends think I'm outgoing, but my best friends know that I'm completely insane. And her mom responded and said, ain't that the truth? Just kidding. She literally wrote, just kidding. Diane didn't have any friends, so she made her daughter her best friend, and the way that they bonded was by killing the entire family. Shortly after the tipster and just a couple days of the interrogations and questionings and obviously the admittance of guilt, both of them were arrested while Sarah was still in the hospital on charges of murder and attempted murder. Now, Sarah, who was not expected to survive, actually did. She survived the near fatal poisonings from her sister and her mother. And during the court case, Rachel, tearfully, now in cuffs with Sarah recovering and free, Rachel told her, I'm sorry that I couldn't find the courage to stand up for what was right, to go for help, to protect you and our siblings. Your suffering could have been prevented, and I hate myself for not being there for you. I want you to know that you're an inspiration to me. Sarah later did read a statement in court that said, I prefer to be a survivor than a victim. I forgive my mom for what she did to me. But she not only took away my dad and brother, but she took away my lifestyle, my livelihood, and my independence. The poisonings made Sarah disabled pretty much for the rest of her life. She had a very diplomatic statement in court, but later in the 2020 interview, this is something else she had to say.
I just felt like I want to slap both of them and calling them B-words.
At just the age of 25, Rachel Stouty pled guilty to second-degree murder. Even though obviously all of this was all planned, she was able to plead second degree because they exchanged it for a testimony against her mother. However, that did not do much for Rachel as she was still given life in prison, and rightfully so. In January 2016, Diane Stouty pled guilty to the first degree murder of Mark Stouty and her son, Sean Stouty. She also pled guilty to assault for the attempted poisoning of her daughter, Sarah Stouty. She took something called an Alford plea that acknowledged that there was significant information to incriminate her, but she never had to admit to the poisonings. To this day, Diane still maintains her innocence. She later said in an interview that, I don't know, my husband was always hanging around with a lot of seedy people. Maybe they slipped him something. That's crazy. Despite the fact that she is on tape in the interrogation saying that she poisoned her husband's Gatorade with antifreeze, she still claims she didn't do it. One thing about the case that really, really irked me was Sarah said later that she misses her family. She misses her brother. She misses her dad. And she also believes that if they were still there, they would have protected her and Sarah may have never been poisoned. I mean, she says that she misses her family. She does not mean Diane and Rachel, because a reporter later asked her, do you still talk to them? Do you still consider them family? And Sarah said,
not anymore. I consider them as killers who hate me.